Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Hello, welcome to today's podcast. I'm delighted to welcome Elia Crevy, Head of Capital Markets at the European Investment Bank. Today we're here to discuss the outlook for European borrowing, the landscape. We'll take a look at some of the highlights of the NGEU. We'll reflect on the growing green, social and sustainable bond market, and we'll also take a look at some important developments lining up for 2022. My name is Martin Stepan. I'm the Managing Director of the Sovereign Debt Institute here at OMFIF. And it's a great pleasure to have Elia join us today as someone who's been at the helm of the EIB for the past 10 years. So firstly, we are mentioning the NextGen EU highlight here, which has obviously radically changed the way the European Union interacts with financial markets. It's certainly ambitious. It's been groundbreaking in terms of the new public debt program. The numbers themselves are quite staggering, with 750 billion plans issued to be by the end of 2026, which means that the EU will borrow around 150 billion euros per year and over the next couple of years. The syndicated transactions have been oversubscribed, and there's been great strong appetite for EU securities from the investor side. The EIB has been a vital European borrower. It is the bank for the European Union. To some extent, one could say that almost that the NGEU is perhaps a competitor to some in some ways to the EIB. But Elia, are there any particular highlights from your perspective?
Well, thank you. Martin, and thank you, Omfif, for this invitation. Where shall I start? I mean, of course, it's been an interesting year again to see how this market develops with such a big new name coming to the market. And I think it's been largely positive because, first of all, of course, when the announcement came, the first concern was, what is this going to do to spreads? What is it going to be sort of cannibalizing other people's investor uptake and so on and so forth? But that has not really happened. I think it has created its own space quite efficiently. Of course, the ECB policies have been a helpful factor, to say the least. But what we have seen is that I think spreads actually initially they widened a bit, but they have actually come back since a long time. But what we have seen is that whereas there were some non-European investors, for example, who thought that before this, none of the national governments was quite large or liquid enough for them because they were comparing with the US Treasuries or the JGBs. Who have now sort of seen that, okay, now we have a comparable product here or which is liquid enough. So I think it has been positive in that way. And of course, the decision by the EU, which came pretty sort of quickly at the time, has been a positive in the political sense as well, as it showed that, okay, we have some, unanimity here on when it matters. When you have a big crisis at hand. So I think it's been largely positive. And like I said, the ECB purchase programs, of course, have been a big help. So we'll have to see how that, how we go, forward with those. I mean, we don't know yet what the ECB is going to do. We'll know, I guess, in a few weeks' time. But, at the same time, I cannot speak for the Commission. It's very, very clear, but, they also, because they are not using the funds themselves like a national government. You have a budget and you know pretty much exactly how you need to borrow. We are an on-lender, but so is the Commission. And I think they can be fairly certain that the grant part will be taken up, but they don't have a certainty on the lending side. So I think what we have seen from banks, how much they estimate that there will be supply from the NGEU program next year, the range is quite wide. And we don't know. I mean, I think they will announce something in November as well, as will we for next year. But just as we have seen this year, that we have had a bit less needs than we thought at the beginning of the year. And when you are not using the funds yourself, that's what happens.
Thank you for that. Absolutely. So you mentioned liquidity and certainly the reflection on the political unanimity has been certainly very important. And looking at, you know, the impact that that the EU as a major issuer has in its own right, and how does this sort of compare with the issuance of other European agencies and some of the other bond programs?
Well, I can only speak for EIB, basically. I cannot speak for the other agencies, but I don't think anybody has particularly suffered from this. So there has been this perception of increased liquidity. We have now several benchmarks. And for EIB's case, which I can speak for, is that we are a slightly different animal in the sense that we are, first of all, a multi-currency issuer. So we only do a part of our program in euros and only part of it in large benchmarks. Even in euros, we have the big product and then we have a smaller product, which we tend to do, for example, in the long end, very long end, which we don't need a whole lot of. And then we have the other product, the climate awareness or the sustainability awareness bonds, which tend to be a bit smaller. So the competition for us is basically on the benchmark side. But since our funding program has not been at the higher end of our historical ranges, we have rather been limiting the size of most of our euro benchmarks at 3 or a few times 4 billion. So it's not a comparison like by like for us. And then, of course, what we do in other currencies, US dollars, pound sterling, etc., this is not really, we are the only one out of the EU institutions who is active in these ones.
And it's an interesting question in terms of it's been flouted that there is a risk of crowding out. So far, we haven't seen that. But obviously, there is going to be a lot of the volume of EU debt issuance is expected to rise. Obviously, again, EIB here is a very important European issuer. How do you, you know, go about perhaps coordinating the issuance programs? To what extent is it, how important is coordinating now, let's say, between the EIB and the other DMOs of Europe?
Well, the DMOs, we know their programs, so DMOs are rather easy. And of course, we cannot avoid everybody at all the time. You know, we just try to avoid on the same day, same maturity. And the same goes obviously for the Commission. They are fairly frequent now. They also have their windows. We don't have such an approach because we need to be a little bit more nimble and we have smaller sizes, so we can do 10 billion issue or 15 billion issue. You may want to announce when that comes, but when you do a 3 billion, that is not really needed. So we work around the dates of the others. And I think the biggest challenge is actually to find the good windows, because first you take out the public holidays in each of the sort of relevant jurisdiction. Then you take out the windows that the Commission is using, or if we want to do, let's say, a 10-year, you see that no sort of, at least a big DMO is doing a 10-year on the same day. So I think this is the biggest challenge. It's not so much about absorption capacity of the market. It's more about those issuance windows. But so far it has worked fine. And I'm sure that we'll find some windows next year. And we have indeed the possibility of alternating between two currencies, even in the large transactions.
You've seen, obviously, you mentioned the uptake in non-EU investors. Is that something you plan on targeting more within the EIB, or how to what extent is the NGU both the crowding out and crowding in capacity that it actually it entices perhaps other issuers or other investors to join in?
Yeah. Ideally, we would of course like to do that target. But the biggest impediment for investment in euro for any issuer is not our competition or the supply. It's really the rates. The non-European interest for Europe paper, euro-denominated paper, is not what it used to be in the best days because of the level of the rates. That is very, very clear. This is not going to be changing dramatically unless we start to see less negative or zero or hopefully one day positive rates. So that is the sort of biggest impediment. And when you have the non-Europeans who don't have a natural need to buy a currency and who can't really go into other currencies, there tends to be a fair amount of sort of trading accounts or sort of hot money which are looking, you know, to buy now and then sell a bit later at the profit. And with our reduced sizes, especially, we tend not to allocate very much to these accounts anyways. So there isn't really the space where one could go with this bond, but if one day we get to more attractive rates, then yes, well, then we'll do the push.
With the inflation risk and some mutterings on that space, so I think we need to look forward for to 2022, and perhaps we'll take it up a little bit later. Final point here on the NGU program, it's been sort of touted as a potential European safe asset. How do you, to what extent would you subscribe to that sort of assessment?
Well, fortunately, that's not my choice or my decision anyways. I mean, yes, there's plenty of talk about it. And I know that some banks treat it already as a sovereign. Some still treat it as an SSA. I think one of the sort of missing parts there is a future or existence of that. So I think it is maybe a close thing to such a thing. But if you only define it by the word safe, yes, is it safe? Yes, absolutely. But if you look at the liquidity and the tradability and the repoability and all this, then I think there's still something to build up, which is not only for one name. It's a bit for everybody, of course, with the purchase programs going on. Liquidity in the secondary market is patchy at best, as I've understood.
Perhaps a quick follow-up here is, to what extent would you want to see this as a permanent fixture? I think is sort of the key question here. I mean, obviously it's more of a political one, but from your perspective,
I think we are pretty neutral on that if we are pricing against swaps or one government or another government or the Commission. I mean, it doesn't really matter for us. So we are big, but we are not sufficiently big to become the market benchmark. So we will always be pricing against another benchmark. And whichever that benchmark happens to be or the market chooses to be, so we'll live with that.
Thank you. Let's change scope and talk a little bit, something quite close to your heart, sustainability. We've had COP26 2 weeks ago. Are there any particular notable highlights for you? I mean, we've had a whole range of different announcements. Is there anything that sticks out for you?
Yeah. Well, we made some quite important announcements. We said, for example, that we will increase substantially our financing for climate change adaptation, which has been less talked about than climate change mitigation, about cutting carbon emissions. And of course, we continue to do that as much as we can. But also adaptation, i.e. Improving resilience for the damage that has already been done, like we have seen floods, for example, in Europe, and then on the other hand, of forest fires. So this needs to be done quite urgently. So we are looking to increase that quite substantially. And then there's another announcement, which is a fairly big change for EIB in the sense that we have been always a bank who finances a project or a certain investment, private sector, public sector, whichever joint efforts. But we have, from the environmental angle, especially, we have evaluated the project, not the counterparty so much. So now we are starting to do both. Of course, we still evaluate the projects, but we will also look at the Paris alignment of the counterparts, whether they have a plan or not. I mean, they don't need to be there yet, but of course we will accompany them, finance the investments that they need to do and advise them if need be. So we will, let's say that if you have this is a silly example, but if you have an oil company who says that we want to have a loan from EIB so that we can power our oil drilling with solar panels without any plan of a transition, then they're probably not our client. But when you have somebody who intends to have a credible transition and has got a plan, then we will support that.
Obviously, one point, if we turn to some of the green bonds, and perhaps I know something that you've been working on around the EU taxonomy. In particular, there's been a lot more interest in green bonds. Obviously, again, post-COP, a lot of sovereign issuance is either being on the rise or certainly planned for next year. But looking at the EU taxonomy, to what extent is it fit for purpose? I mean, it's come under a lot of attack, criteria around forestry or biofuels, that it harms biodiversity. There've been critics, for it. That's not necessarily scientifically robust, although it is, again, a useful guide to some investors, but there is more risk of greenwashing as a result.
I think the important thing in the taxonomy is that it remains science-based, because science is what it is. If it says that this is how much we need to cut emissions so that we are a zero carbon society by 2050, which is the agreement from Paris, then this is what we need to do. And if you want to do something else, well, maybe that is a political decision, but then it's either not 2050 or it's not 1.5 degrees or it's not zero carbon. Something's got to give. This was the agreement that this is what countries will do all around the world. And if you deviate from that, then you have to move something else, either the degree target or the year target or something. So that's how it works. So we'll see now on the 8th of December what the vote will be on the technical screening criteria of the climate path adaptation and mitigation. And there are, of course, I think there's still quite a lot of misunderstandings there, in the sense that if you are not in the taxonomy, then you are somehow considered brown or bad. I mean, this is not at all the case. This taxonomy is only for the sort of, let's say, dark green, if I use colloquial expressions, or the greenest of the green. But if you are outside, it means that you can be totally neutral. Like, let's say, a consulting firm probably does not produce a lot of emissions, but cannot save them much either, because they have nothing to save from. You can be slightly green or slightly brown, or you can be very brown. All of these activities, that kind of activities, are outside the taxonomy. So it doesn't mean much to say that I'm not in there. And this is, I think, what people are getting very passionate about, that I want to be in because I'm not the bad guy. that's really a big misunderstanding. I've seen that in many places, even in my own country. So one should also look well into it, and whether some limits or criteria are too tight or not tight enough. I'm not a scientist. I really can't tell, but I can just tell that yes, it should be science based, and then you do what you can do. Either you are in or you are out, but the targets cannot change because I don't like it or I do like it.
And the taxonomy is an important benchmark, and it's an important piece which hopefully will be able to fit in. And obviously it might obviously develop throughout the later stages. Talking a little bit about sovereign green bonds, we can see lots of more countries suddenly becoming much more interested, issuing or planning to issue at least. To what extent do you think that we're approaching a situation where we need to have a national green agenda as well as a green bond program in order to take the greenness seriously?
Well, I would say that national green agenda is absolutely a must, because that you have to have. How you finance that with normal bonds or green bonds or any other colored bonds, that's kind of a choice. So it's the investments and the transition and the change which is making making things happen. And this taxonomy is like a tool there. So it shows that this is where I need to be if I want to go from A to B. People talk a lot about it as a sort of reporting framework, but it is first and foremostly, in my opinion, it is like a assessment tool. What do I need to do in terms of my investments and my transition plan? Then green bonds from governments or from anybody else, I very much welcome them. The more the merrier, basically. What that does is to give a certain signal, and it gives transparency towards the investors and the market, that this is what our program will be. This is how we do it. It gives kind of investors can talk about this, challenge governments on these topics anyways. But when you do a green bond, then you are certainly allowed to challenge and discuss and ask and probe. And then, of course, the government also will have much more information available because they need to prepare for the discussion. So green bond is a tool for transparency and explaining your situation and where you want to be to investors and other stakeholders possibly. Whereas taxonomy is a tool that explains you how to get there. And then we have the political decisions which decide whether they want to take this transition and whether they want to issue green bonds. And that's basically how I see it.
Yeah. Great. As you change tack a little bit and take a look, you know, if you look into your crystal ball and take a look at developments that we have coming up for 2020, we were talking a little bit earlier about expecting borrowing for 2020 is expected to be lower, certainly than we've had over the past 2 years as the COVID recovery sort of peters out. But set against that, there is wide speculation that ECB is likely to reduce its asset purchases as potentially interest rates might go up. We've certainly seen that in certain parts of the EU, in Central and Eastern Europe. What do you expect the net supply dynamic to look like for next year?
Well, unfortunately, ECB, although they are another European institution, they do not share their secrets with us. We know what the supply picture looks like on that side, issuance side. So yes, there will be a bit less. I mean, we will most likely be doing less next year than we have this year. But we know that the PEP is going to be finished. Is it going to be replaced by something? Is something else going to be increased? I guess we have to hold our horses for a couple of more weeks to hear in December what the ECB does. But obviously, that's a big a factor for all of this. Otherwise, we know that the issue volumes will go down. But one important thing is also the kind of tenors that issues of governments will be tapping on, because if there is a, even if we do not have inflation going out of not going out of control, but going out of the sort of band that people expect it to be with. The question is in the air, and the word has been expressed now. We have not been talking about inflation for at least 10 years. Now we are, and we have different views. Some say it's temporary, some say it's more persistent. I don't know which it will be, but the word is out there and it's in the air. So I think the long end will be a bit more turbulent next year. We get one number published somewhere, and then we rally, and then we get another number, and then we sell off. So I think that will be much more choppy at the long end. So if there will be as much very long end issues as there has been these past couple of years, that probably will contribute to more turbulence. So that's also important. Where does this supply go to? Which segment?
Another very important development is around technology. This year, the EIB, you recently issued your bond via DLT. How important is this initiative for capital markets, and you know, if we start exploring tokenization of securities, central banks start considering CBDCs, how important is this an element, and what do you expect for next year?
That now goes into the sort of area of crystal ball. I think it is important. We are dedicating certainly some time and effort into it. But the advantages are definitely not for any immediate consumption or even near future consumption. That we know. There are plenty of issues there still. And for example, when we did ours, it took quite a long time to prepare. And to our surprise, the problems were not so much in the technical field, but quite a lot of them were in the legal field. And not all of these questions have been resolved just because we did one issue. So we are pushing the envelope, to use an old phrase, adding new features into the next transactions that we want to do. So I think it will change something, but I would not go and try to predict what it changes, because I take you one example. 25 years ago or so, people started to have more and more mobile phones. And we all thought that, well, the best thing with mobile phone is that I can sit, you know, I can be skiing on the slopes, I can do anything I want, and I can talk on the phone. Now these phones, we have our whole life there. So it's our work, it's our entertainment, it's our contacts, it's our banking, it's our travels, it's everything. So if you had tried to predict 25 years ago, what does it mean that everybody will have a mobile phone? You would have been just totally on the wrong track. And I think if I tried to predict it, I would be equally, at least as much on the wrong track with blockchain. But something it will change. That I'm quite convinced about.
The final development on the personal note, you're stepping down in your role as head of capital markets at the end of January, but you'll continue on as a chief sustainable finance advisor at the bank. Can you tell us a little bit more about what this role is going to entail?
Yes. So first, the idea is that from 1st of February 22, I will be working part time. How much exactly? But I think I intend to keep it well below 50%, because in our line of work, if you work 100%, you actually work 150% and so on and so forth. So 50 becomes 100. I'm trying to avoid that. I keep it a bit less. But the sustainable finance is really the area where I want to work. And there's one very concrete and very actually work intensive thing that I will take care about is I'm already a member of this platform for sustainable finance. We have several people who are there from EIB. We have technical experts, but I'm from the market side together with Peter Munro. And I will continue that because that's not day-to-day management of EIB finances. It's actually quite separate. But you need the market background there, and market people are not that many even in the platform. So I think that's quite useful both ways. So I will continue with that. And what comes on top of that, or besides that, we'll see. That's open yet, but that at least I will keep and continue until I think it's going on at least until end of next year. So that's the sort of concrete part which I know, and the rest is left a little bit open. So.
Thank you very much, Nadia, for speaking to me today. It's been very informative, and certainly wish you all the very best in your new role. Very exciting times.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.